This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nichols Patrick CPE and provided by your state society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nichols Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nichols Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the weekly tax update for Monday, April 22nd, 2013. We have a short list this week. It was kind of a slow week. The IRS has announced the disbarment of a California CPA. It's the first one I've seen for unconscionable fees. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And then a ruling that a portion of statutory disability benefits, that is, a portion of a retired person's pension equal to that pension he would have had if he were disabled, is excludable from his income, but the portion of his pension that exceeds that is not. And then limits on the offset of self-employment tax refunds having to do with related to the IRS's great effort being expended on worker classification. A tax court decision denying Barnes Group the benefit of a complex tax plan that it paid PricewaterhouseCoopers about $500,000 to design that really related to a disguised repatriation of offshore earnings, and a taxpayer who for some reason thought she was an exception to the Internal Revenue Code and that she could file a separate return, married filing separate, and claim the adoption expense deduction. She can't because the law specifically says she can't. And finally, a report headline says the IRS destroyed more than 12,000 reports of fraud in fiscal 2012. And we're going to talk a little bit about exactly what that means. Let's start with the disbarment of Anthony Tongson. Mr. Tongson gave advice to clients that they should use a Form 2555 and treat their California earned income as foreign source income. Some of us have thought that about California, but we've not been brave enough to take the return position. He did that on at least 52 tax returns. That constituted disreputable conduct. His failure to research the legitimacy of the filing position specifically violated the due diligence standards of Circular 230. And then it turns out he was taking these return positions on a contingent fee basis and lied about that to the IRS Criminal Investigation Division. In short, he violated a number of the parts of Circular 230, and he no longer practices before the Internal Revenue Service. Next, a question regarding whether or not a retired individual's pension is fully taxable. The individual was disabled, accidental disability, after he reached normal retirement age, and that happens. A lot of employees of state and federal governments have reached normal retirement age, but continue. I mean, they meet all the qualifications in terms of age and years of service, but they continue to work. In this case, the individual was accidentally disabled. So his pension, calculated under two provisions of the state pension plan to which he was a participant, was the sum of, as a disability pension, the sum of an annuity for his accumulated contributions plus a pension equal to 2/3 of his average final compensation. There was an exception that related to his pension. If he was getting a full pension, then the portion of the full pension that would have been paid as a disability pension was separately identified. Because of that separate identification, the IRS says that the entire amount of pension received by this employee is not taxable, and the pension plan is not required to report the full amount, but rather only the 1/3 that exceeds the 2/3 that would be payable as a disability pension in any event. That, by the way, is a letter ruling, 2013-15001. Next, we have an electronic communication, an email coming out of the Chief Counsel's office addressing the question of what happens when workers are reclassified and then they file refund claims seeking to recover the full amount of their self-employment tax. Can they get the full amount back in a refund? And the answer is no. They can only get the employer portion because the worker would have been liable for the employee portion in any event. That's Electronic Communication 2013-15023, addressing a Section 6521 refund situation. I hadn't seen anything like that before, and I thought you might find it interesting, especially since the IRS has a major effort underway to reclassify workers. They've got about 600 revenue officer examiners across the country doing nothing else, and we're going to have a lot of situations where workers get reclassified. They've paid the self-employment tax. Now they want a refund. They're not going to be able to get a refund of the employee portion because they got to pay that anyway. They can get a refund of the employer portion. Now we have Barnes Group, TC Memo 2013-109. Barnes Group was earning about 2% on the cash it had in foreign corporations, and they were paying 6% on their loans, 6 to 7% on their loans in the United States. There's about $40 million in the swing here. Barnes had about $40 million stuck in offshore accounts, and they wanted to figure out a way to get it back into the United States so they could pay off their U.S. bank loans and save the arbitrage on the interest. Makes a lot of sense, right? The problem is, when you repatriate earnings, you got to pay tax on them. Well, Barnes didn't want to pay the tax, but they wanted to get about $40 million back into the U.S. finance system. So they shopped around for a public accounting firm that would help them with a tax opinion. They found at PricewaterhouseCoopers, they found a willing accomplice. And so PricewaterhouseCoopers designed a very complex system where it involved setting up foreign corporations, which then purchased the stock of a finance company, which then made loans back to Barnes, the parent holding company. To be fair, the executives, who were all very experienced and apparently very smart, because they had been hired to take Barnes out of the doldrums and make it an active, attractive investment. They were obviously very smart. They were so smart they did not follow the advice in the PricewaterhouseCoopers letter to the letter. So they didn't follow the opinion letter. And for that reason, they wound up paying a little over $2 million in penalties on this transaction. What's really interesting is that because of various net operating losses, foreign tax credits, the tax was about $3,400,000. The penalty was over $2 million. It's a complex case. It's a complex ruling. It's a 22-page opinion. The lesson here should really be that this is a fundamental problem of the tax profession today. We had a otherwise respected tax advisor, PricewaterhouseCoopers, cooked up a complex series of transactions that had virtually no substance. The people at PricewaterhouseCoopers knew or certainly should have known that their transaction had very little substance, but they got a fat fee by just on the chance that the client might be able to save a lot of money. The creation of unnecessary entities to create a technical reliance on a revenue ruling really should be thought of, and Monty Jekyll wrote a comment in Tax Analyst. He said, going back to the old shibboleth, it's too good to be true. And if it's too good to be true, it probably is not true. Go, Monty. Now, a very simple, straightforward Nancy Lewis Field, TC Memo 2013-111. Ms. Field argued that the fact that she was married and filed a married filing separate return should not bar her claiming a $10,144 adoption credit. She did, in fact, adopt a child in 2009. She was, in fact, married in 2009. The problem is, Code Section 23 says married taxpayers can only claim the adoption credit when they file a joint return. Ms. Field thought that her circumstances, she had adopted previously as a single parent, should have created an exception to the statute. She argued that the requirement that she must file a joint return in order to claim the credit was unconstitutional. That argument got nowhere with the U.S. Tax Court. They are, however, going to consider, so that the IRS got summary judgment on the tax. The question then becomes, is Ms. Field liable for about $2,000 addition to tax for just ignoring the law? And whether or not she had a good faith belief that the law did not apply to her exactly in this circumstance is a question for trial, and we can look forward perhaps to seeing an opinion, or perhaps the IRS and Ms. Fields will settle. Now, just a caution. Here's a 17-page report from the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, and the headline is, IRS destroyed more than 12,000 reports of fraud in 2012. That sounds damning, does it not? However, they processed 274,976 Forms 3949A reporting fraud, and that resulted in total assessments of $66.5 million. So what's the error rate? If 12,000 were destroyed because they were improperly filled out or hard to understand, that is a 0.043640 error rate, 4.364%. Not bad. This is just an example of how sometimes even tax analysts produces a headline that is more for show and more to attract attention than it is to communicate real good information to we tax practitioners. Well, it was a slow week, and it's a short program this week. Thank you for joining me. Our watchword, of course, is stay safe.